True police stories of the strange and unexplained. Detective Sergeant Ingrid P. Dean put together this book that you heard an earlier version of a couple of years ago on Coast to Coast with George Norrie. Now, slightly new version and some really terrific commentary along the way, trying to understand what life is like for police officers out on the fringe of life. And more on that coming up next, this time from Officer Herman Brown and the wake-up story that you'll never forget on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. All right, so Herman Brown is a police officer. I'm going to let Ingrid introduce here on Coast to Coast. Ingrid?
Yes, Trooper Herman Brown is with the Michigan State Police, and he is stationed in Adrian, Michigan. And again, he was one of the first officers that contributed a story to my book project. So we have a special connection, and he's going to share the story, Wake Up.
All right, so first of all, let me say, Herman Brown, I think we, regardless of whether you're a police officer or not, anybody who works a third shift, anybody who spends a little time driving in between things when their body rhythm is off can relate to this story.
Oh, yeah. I imagine. Definitely.
So I loved it. But it was by coincidence. It was when I was telling some people about today when I was trying to explain what tonight's Coast is about, and it's a great Coast story. Tell the background before the before Wake Up happened, where you were coming from that night, all the things that you had been doing before the experience.
Like I said, I was working the late shift. I was working at 12-hour shift. Usually my shift starts at 3 in the afternoon and ends at 3 in the morning. So prior to even going to work, you know, of course, I have a home and I'm married and kids are grown. So I had stuff to do at home as far as yard work and stuff like that. So all day I had been going, doing things prior to leaving for work. And then my drive, I go to work and then most of my shift I'm driving as it is. So all day I'm busy. So with my 12 hours of work, working prior to work, that day I was kind of wore out. And I remember as I drove home, I was definitely falling asleep. Like Inger said, that I worked for the state police. Now, I live in Adrian, but I work in Monroe. Monroe is 40 miles one way to my home. So once I ended my shift that night, that's when I started on my way home.
And driving home, would you say that you could tell that night was there was going to be something different that was going to happen? Any sign that this was anything out of the ordinary?
No, it was just a regular shift. Working okay. For the state police and out of the post I am, we do more than freeway. There's times so I'm taking runaway kids complaints, harassing phone calls. So it was a typical busy day. I just remember when I was heading home that night or that morning, I was really tired because I can feel myself, nodding off as you drive. And my drive from Monroe to Adrian, there's a lot of farm fields. So the route that I usually take is called M50. It's a two-lane highway, no street lights, and 90% of the drive is between farmer fields. So I knew I was working extra hard to keep myself awake as I drove back home.
Okay. And so as you're trying to keep awake, you're driving back home. Explain what happens next.
Okay. I passed a town that's called Dundee. That puts me about halfway home. And I knew I was getting really tired because as I'm driving, at the time I had a Nissan pickup truck, a small one. And I just knew I was falling asleep because I would hit the rumble strips on the shoulder and, you know, try to maintain the lanes. But there's no traffic out there in those wee hours of the morning. So I'm trying everything I can to keep myself awake. But then after I passed the town of Dundee, I remember I didn't realize it, but now I'm sound asleep. I'm driving in probably about 60, 65 miles an hour in a 55 lane. And I remember I heard this noise, and it was coming more in my right ear, and it was just like, you know, this buzzing sound. So the nose to me, I'm sound asleep. What made me realize I was sleeping, the noise continued to get louder and finally it became words, and I heard what it sounded like was someone saying, "Wake up." Now, I'm the only one in my truck, and the Nissan truck that I had was a small truck, and I'm a pretty big guy, so if somebody's sitting next to me, we're going to be almost touching. That's how small my truck is. No back seat.
So I've been in one of those trucks before. I know just what you're talking. I know just that is so not a typical truck cab right there. It's like being in a rickshaw.
Exactly. It's not like one of these Ford one.
No.
They got the back seat. No, this is just a small pickup truck, and I'm hearing what I sounds like someone saying, "Wake up!" And as I'm slowly waking up, it's getting louder. You know how you ever fall asleep in front of the TV, and when you wake up, the TV seems extremely loud? It was the same thing. And it got to the point where it sounded like someone was yelling, "Wake up." Now, when my eyes opened, I realized both hands were still on the wheel. I already felt that I'm hitting the rumble strips, and my chin is touching my chest. So my I'm out cold.
The rumble strip is that the rumble strip is along the side of the road where they kind of corrugate the, would that be a good word for it? I don't know what you call that. Where they put the perforations in the roadway so that when your tires hit it, it makes a big noise.
Yeah, they put them in the rumble. So they put them on the shoulder, and it's to alert the driver that you're driving off the roadway. Because even a lot of times we see people drive off the roadway. And before it was so smooth,
you'd never know.
Actually on the road. So yeah. The rumble strips are there to wake you up, to make you realize you are now about to leave the roadway.
Now, so, I've never heard the name for them before. I've seen them for years, and I had no idea that they had a name. I love that. So you're hitting but the rumble strip didn't wake you up.
No, it didn't wake me. That's why I knew it. I was so tired that day. And like I said, I never, you had times where you close your eyes and don't remember a portion of the roadway that you were actually driving, that you drove past a section of roadway. And that's happened to me before. But this time, like I said, when I woke up and my chin is touching my chest, that lets me know I am out cold. And the bad thing is I'm still driving.
Yeah.
So like I said, I remember waking up, open up my eyes, and I'm looking down in my lap, and I'm thinking, I'm asleep. Now I can feel my truck going to the rumble strips. And now I know this area because I've been driving this for years. Now I'm about to hit the shoulder, the gravel shoulder, which drops off in the ditch.
Right.
So, but I hear this loud noise in my right ear that someone's yelling, "Wake up." So I remember looking up at the road, seeing the truck is starting to go on a decline sideways. I'm still going fairly straight, but I'm angling towards the ditch. Ugh. And I'm thinking, what is this noise? And I look over my passenger seat, and here I see someone looking at me. I mean, we're looking at each other so close that it seems like our noses are almost touching. But the thing is, all I can see is this white light with the eyes and the nose and the mouth section was all dark. And it didn't look like somebody I recognized. The voice never sounded familiar to me, like somebody I knew. All I remember, it looked, the figure, the facial expressions and everything looked like a guy, but it was all bright light, and the mouth I can see forming as it's yelling at me, "Wake up." And it's looking at me, right? We're looking at each other eye to eye, and I'm thinking, what is that? And as I'm looking, I can remember feeling the truck starting to go down the shoulder.
Right.
And I look back to the roadway, and just because our extensive driving program, I've been driving for years, I knew not to panic, take my foot off the gas, slowly steer off the ditch, off the shoulder gravel, the gravel shoulder back towards the roadway, get my truck back under control. So I did that, get back on the roadway and stop my truck on the shoulder, and I look over, and this person, whoever it was, is now sitting back up against the seat, looking straight ahead, and slowly just fading away.
How about that?
And I'm sitting there thinking, this didn't happen. There's no way this has happened. One, it's not enough room for somebody to sit here. Two, who would be sitting in my truck looking like this, and all of a sudden it just fade away. So I'm sitting there. Oh, I'm wide awake now. Oh, you can bet that.
Right. Oh, yeah.
And my brain is trying to figure out, what was that and who was it? And then I realized, because I can see up the road with the way I was going, there was a culvert coming. And if I would have went off the road at that speed, I'd have hit that culvert. And I've been to accidents where people have hit the culvert. Culvert is a portion of the roadway off the shoulder where it usually has like a steel pipe through underneath the ground so water can travel back and forth under the roadway out to the fields and stuff.
Right.
And people that hit that, and it's surrounded by concrete or brick. And I've never had all of many accidents I've had with people hitting those. None of them ever were good. And I kept thinking I was headed straight towards that, rolling about 65 miles an hour. I said, if I hadn't woke up, I would have been either seriously injured or killed in that crash.
Well, in that little pickup truck, that not exactly, it didn't have a, you know, I'm not besmirching the good name of the producers of that truck, but it probably didn't have a big crumple zone in the front. You were the crumple zone, I would
say. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I would have been in, I'd have been okay where I would have stayed in the vehicle only because I was belted in. But
right.
Yeah, like you said, that thing would have crumpled right around me and hit the culvert at that speed with no braking.
I can only imagine.
Yeah.
Herman, you were convinced that that was not a dream either.
Oh, no, it wasn't a dream because the thing was, as I'm hitting that gravel shoulder and the rumble shorts, I can hear the gravel hitting up against the truck. I can feel the decline of the truck. And at this time, I am wide awake and seeing I'm going straight for the ditch. So, you know, even steering back out, coming over and coming to a stop and looking over and still seeing this person or whatever it was slowly fading away. No, this was no dream. I wasn't in my bed. I was in the patrol car parked somewhere, and I sure wasn't sitting in my truck park. I was still rolling down the road.
So going by what you felt you were experiencing, if you had to identify who you felt it was sitting next to you in that cab, in that small pickup truck telling you to wake up, who was it?
Oh, I got to figure it's the guardian angel. You know, and I kind of, you know, I've had relatives that's passed away, my stepbrother, uncles, and no one that I knew as a family member or friend has passed away. Look. Or sounded like this person. But this person, I tell you, had a male voice. The features on his face were smooth, but you can tell if it was a woman or a male, and I would say definitely was a male. And we were looking each other eye to eye. And like I say, you couldn't see no eyes. It was just dark spots of the eyes, the nose, and I could see. And that was the thing about it. Not only was it yelling at me to wake up, but I can watch his mouth form the words at the same time. And I'm thinking, what is this? And, you know, as being a police officer, you know, we always hear about guardian angels. You hear about when you're a kid and somebody's really looking out for you. And, you know, different situations that you get into. You know, you could think, man, I almost got hit by a car. Somebody's looking out for me. God's protecting me. Or I got my guardian angel. And like I said, looking face-to-face with that person, the bright light, never hearing that voice before, I got to think that had to be my guardian angel.
Yeah, very interesting. Now, I want to ask you, this is going to sound like kind of a weird question, but, you know, sometimes with the guardian angel stories, there's a component to that where if somebody, say a fellow police officer, is killed in the line of duty, people will ask, well, where was his guardian angel? You know, how was it that that officer walked into what turned out to be a bad stop or was, you know, caught by somebody who they didn't see and nobody yelled, wake up or look out or something to them. So how do you process that you experienced something that saved you, whereas other people I'm sure you have known in your many years as a state police officer, somebody else didn't get the benefit of? How do you work that out?
Well, just like in Ingrid's book, The True Police Stories of the Strain and Unexplained, I think it's a situation where I truly believe that everybody has a time limit. And when I say time limit, I think there's a preset time and date that you're going to die. No one knows when that time is going to be. For example, we just had, what was it, last year, a Marine. I served in the Marine Corps prior to joining the state police. We had a Marine that was over in Afghanistan, been in several firefights. He comes home on leave after spending 2 years in Afghanistan, and he's in a car with his girlfriend and driving up the roadway. A drunk crosses the center line and kills him. I think you have a preset date and time when you're going to die. We, unfortunately, we don't know when it is, and it just was not my time yet.
That's one way of looking at it, and I think that's totally fair. Now, I'll say that if I need a guardian angel to tell me to wake up sometime, I hope it has your voice, because I think that was...
Me too.
That's all I'm hoping.
Well, believe it or not, you wouldn't be the first person to tell me that. We get a lot of people that listen to the scanners on the radio when we're on patrol. So it's not unusual for me to go into a house. And I got to say, even though some of the guys, I always enjoy it more when the women tell me that.
Yeah,
that
well,
enjoy hearing my voice on the radio.
You should be on the radio, and I should be some deputy somewhere, some Barney Fife-like deputy. But so thank you so much for contributing that story and to the book, and then also here to us here on Coast to Coast, when we're talking about true police stories of the strange and unexplained. Now, Herman Brown, you were saved. You said it wasn't your time. Your guardian angel spoke to you. Can you then connect this to something else that happened a little further down the road in your life that you know if you had died that night, you wouldn't have been there to be an agent of change or justice that you needed to be there for, that you perhaps would have been saved for that purpose?
Yeah, and that's the thing. You know, I don't know what that purpose is right now, but I got to figure that God is keeping me around for some reason. And I think it also depends on what you do in your life. I always figure, even though we have a time limit here, you have to do the things to make the best of your life. So I've done lots of volunteer work. I've worked with kids. I volunteer and feed the elderly once a week. I've been doing that for over 10 years now. So I think, you know, God has a plan for us, but it's just a matter of you just doing something positive. And I think even though we have bad people out there, it's just not my time to go yet. And in the meantime, he's keeping me around because, you know, even in my job, I've had a lot of times where people, I have talked them out of committing suicide or talked them out of hurting someone very seriously, killing them. And I think that I was put here and put in this position to save somebody else. So I think that is a bigger plan than what I know. So I just try to live my life the best way I can, and hopefully the man upstairs or the woman upstairs approves what I'm doing and keeps me around that much longer.
Well, I love that. And thank you so much for sharing your story. And yes, I think that's a good wake up for everybody. Herman Brown, one of the many featured police officers and true police stories of the strange and unexplained. Who's coming up next, Ingrid?
Retired Sergeant Val Rosales from Los Angeles, California.
And real quickly, what would be the title of Val's story?
He submitted a story entitled The Fall of Light, and it is in our new book, True Police Stories of the Strange and Unexplained. And his story seems to fall under the category of a definite UFO sighting.
Love
it. And it takes place in South Dakota at Ellsworth Air Force Base.
Very interesting. Very cool. We'll come back for that then coming up in just a minute, just to show you a wide variety of experiences. I want to get her on to the subject of suicide, though, coming up, too, because Herman mentioned being able to stop people from that. And there's a very interesting story in the book about it, too. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. So that's what it's like. It's when you have an experience of the strange and unexplained, it is like a time warp. Suddenly, it's just like suddenly you are in a place where you can, in one way, never leave. You're always tied to that moment, just as you heard with Herman Brown. he can still tell you everything about that experience. It's so vivid for him, the experience of Wake Up that's in the book True Police Stories of the Strange and Unexplained. But there's others in this book that are just as profound, where they weren't necessarily as mystical. And one of those is a story I want to get to coming up at some point with Ingrid P. Dean about a police officer who was so despondent and was going through what a lot of police officers go through, a time when they were considering suicide. And it's what happened to him before and after that makes the book True Police Stories of the Strange and Unexplained. We'll get to that coming up later on. But first, Anthony Val Rosales, police officer from Los Angeles, tells his UFO story of the strange and unexplained next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So, Val Rosales, thank you so much for joining us. Ingrid, you want to do the introduction here?
Yes. At the time that Val Rosales had seen this fall of light or was involved in this incident, he was a police sergeant in the 44th Security Police Group. And it's an incident that he never reported and nobody ever reported in his group, military group, which is like so many other military sightings that have occurred, especially where nukes were present. I've read about so many UFOs that seem to, like, protect those areas. And Val firmly believes that the incident did not originate from our planet, that it really was a UFO sighting from another world.
So interesting. Val Rosales, so you were in, as we hipsters in the upper Midwest refer to it as, you were in SODAC at the time?
Yes, I was, Ian. And by the way, thank you for having me on the show. I'm really, really honored to actually be in True Police Stories of the Strange and Unemployed.
Unemployed.
I think actually the aliens now are probably unemployed with this story.
That's a good cover, but I really like that.
Anyway, Strange and Unemployed. I need Trooper Brown's Angel now.
That's so funny.
I should probably elaborate on the location. This is the breadbasket of America. In South Dakota, there is a large contingent of the Minuteman II. I think it was upgraded to the III before they pulled out in 1994. The Minuteman II ICBM is a 60-foot-long dual warhead device used for intercontinental ballistic missiles in the defense of the nation in the event of a nuclear attack at the time. Right. Most of the ICBM sites, whether it's the Titan or the Minuteman systems, are in the so-called breadbasket of America, the heartland, so to speak, or the Great Plains.
Sure.
Now, my duties at the time were actually, as a junior NCO, I was the supervisor of a contingent of airmen. There usually was six at any given time. What I had happen one night was, which was very common, many of the ICBM sites are scattered throughout an awful lot of the heartland. Actually, I was much further away from Ellsworth Air Force Base, about 65 miles into an area known as Belfouche, South Dakota. This area is very, very desolate. They have gotten accustomed to the missile sites over the many years that they were situated there. They're about 1/8 square of a mile. Fenced off, they have these three alarm devices. They have their own floodlights that the security can show up and turn on with the key. When you get what they call the situation, which is essentially alarm, the officers down in the capsule underneath the ground will call me, the FSC, or the flight security controller, and inform us of this situation. I sent a crew, what is known as the security elite alert team, out to the site. Now, it's not unusual for us to have radio transmission problems, but no sooner were Airman Grossman, was one partner's name, the other senior partner was Airman First Class Stanley Barber or Baber, depends on who you talk to at the time. They showed up, and they got on the radio, and there seemed to be pretty much a routine experience. Nothing had happened. The alarm system is very sensitive. They go in there, and they turn on the light, and they proceed to check it on foot very carefully. When suddenly, the way the boys described it when they got back, was that it was as if a light, remarkably intense, overpowering light fell upon them from the sky. They never saw anything in. They never heard anything. It was as if it just came from nowhere. And I assure you at the time, the guys did not think it was divinity. It wasn't the second coming.
Right.
This to them, they knew was otherworldly. when they attempted to communicate with me, the FSC, and this is with fairly good radio systems that we had in the early 70s, but like I said, static was pretty common. There was a great deal of trouble in making any kind of communication with us, and we didn't have cell phones in those days.
Right.
When they did get through, Airman Grossman, who's actually from a German immigrant family, was so excited over the radio, he began speaking to me in German. Stanley Weber, on the other hand, took control of the mic and said, "We are returning to mic one." That was the situation we were, that was the actual location that I was at. And they returned to tell the story. Now, this is when the story gets good.
That was good already. It was already good.
Okay. When they get back there, the look on their face, Ian, I'd give anything of the events in my life, of everything I've ever seen, to have a video of this. When they return, you can see their faces, something has happened. Because they sounded so excited, I alerted the other team members in case we had some kind of an armed incident, which was, well, never really happened in the history of the ICBM system for the Air Force.
Right.
They come inside of my office. Stanley Weber, who always was a very level-headed guy, wanted nothing to do with this. He would have been just happy if everybody forgot about it, and he could have pretended that nothing had happened. Grossman, on the other hand, was a lot more elaborate in describing what happened. It was from him that he actually described the light falling upon them, an incredibly intense light. I don't remember them saying anything about heat. They just were amazed that, you know, you have to remember this was late at night, and there's already floodlights on the place. But these lights overpowered these military floodlights, which, by the way, you could sit there in the middle of the night and read fine print
to
the floodlights. Imagine these lights that overpowered the site were so overwhelming that the floodlights might as well not have been on. Both of them were extremely agitated, very, very upset. They know how to defend themselves if there were, God forbid, if there were saboteurs, if there were some kind of people intent upon doing harm.
Sure.
They would have known how to defend themselves. They're armed, they're trained, and they're pretty smart kids. They know what to do. But when you're faced with something that you can't define as friend or foe, you have no idea where it's coming from or what it is. You can imagine how startling it was for a 20-year-old and a 19-year-old.
Yeah.
I myself was only 22 at the time. I just stood there aghast. Stanley was shaking. Airman Grossman, who was normally very level-headed, was, like I said, he was going back and forth between English and German. It was really an experience. We got everybody out there. At some point, they decided, okay, I'm going to call CSC, but I knew I had to talk to the officers on the site. These would be the missile crew officers, the ones that go downstairs in rotating shifts of 12 hours. There was a senior captain there, a man with premature white hair. He comes walking out only in half of his uniform with a T-shirt, a pipe, and a cup of coffee, and he's just looking at me when I'm relaying the story. He asked Stanley, he asked Grossman to repeat the story. They did. He looked at me, and the first thing he said, "You know we can't report this," or words to that effect. And being a respectful enlisted man, I said, "I don't understand, sir. Why is that? I'm supposed to report all incidents." He says, "Do you want to spend the next conceivable hours being interviewed by the OSI?" That's the Office of Special Investigation. That's the Criminal Investigative Group of the United States Air Force.
Sure.
I told him I didn't understand what you mean. We haven't done anything wrong. And he says, "Well, they're going to question you. You're going to be basically interrogated. And then somebody's going to suggest you go get your head examined." And frankly, he just wasn't going to go for it. I told him, well, CSC, which is the overall Central Security Control radio system, monitoring all transmissions throughout the entire 44th missile group. And these guys have heard this. He told me he was just going to go talk to somebody. He left our presence. We were in kind of a living room sort of environment. He went into my office, got on the phone, talked to somebody, and came back and says, "It's forgotten. Don't write it down. Don't say anything to anybody about it unless you want to find yourself under investigation." And that's where the story ended. And I regret it all of my life. Never. I would not have encouraged anybody to defy an officer.
Sure.
But it was my feeling at the time we greatly failed in our duties by not reporting this incident, because these guys didn't make this up. The look on their face said everything, Ian.
Right.
And
no,
my
I
own
totally
gut
believe
feeling
you.
Was they experienced something completely otherworldly.
And if it had been just one, you might have thought somebody nodded off, maybe that this is a bad dream or whatever. But when you have two people who experience the same thing, who have two different human reactions to the same stimuli, That lets you know that there was something that was there. There was some stimulus that caused them to have this reaction. And that's the part that makes you think, okay, we're assuming it's otherworldly, but, you know, I think that also would have been worthy of the investigation to try to see whether or not there was a human or an earthly explanation for it.
Well, that's what I would have thought. In the OSI, to my mind, which I have a lot of respect for them, you think that that would be their major interest. Obviously, though, their orders come from, at the time, there's no longer a Strategic Air Command. Their orders at that time regarding this particular incident would have come from Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska. I actually don't know, of course, you know, because we didn't report it. I have no way of knowing exactly what the procedures would have been. I really doubt that they would have, you know, once they talked to Baber, once they talked to Grossman, like I said, these were credible guys. They were really good at their job. They were very professional for young men. They were stand-up. They were completely reliable. I think at some interval they would have thought to themselves, something happened here and we need to get to the bottom of it. The coincidence that Ingrid brings up is that there's a number of these sightings that I discovered over the years, which is why I finally decided to start telling the story. They always seem to occur where there are nuclear facilities, nuclear equipment. Doesn't that suggest that if there is another world intelligence, that one concern they might have if they're thinking about visiting us is what our weaponry is?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm an easy sell on that. So, I mean,
I'm glad you are, because I never was.
Yeah.
You know, personally, I think there's sort of a government conspiracy going on. I think our government knows so much more than they've ever divulged, and think that they scare the crap out of military servicemen, especially the command level.
I want to ditto on that one.
You know, to report anything.
I might point out
like, they probably threaten them to go, that they'll be in prison the rest of their life. That's my feeling.
Well, there was an inference that we were going to be under intense scrutiny. I might add, now, I'm not trying to be silly here, but considering how I started out, but for those people, especially the listeners who have seen the movie Close Encounters of a Third Kind, a short distance.
I love your malapropism,
yeah,
dude.
I don't know, I'm wondering about that. You know, I'm full of coffee
of the third
right
time.
Now, I'm normally a listener.
That's great.
Anyway,
just love that, actually.
About half an hour or a 45-minute drive into Wyoming is, guess what? Devil's Tower.
Oh yeah, you know what? You know, there's that, and I spent a little time in the Dakotas, and that is almost, I mean, you mentioned, you know, isolated area. Almost all of the Dakotas are isolated. I mean, it doesn't take long to get out
isolated.
Into.
I love it myself,
but it is.
By the way, would this make your program feel really good? I have already gotten 3 texts from my friends who are listening to the show.
I'm sure.
And I didn't tell them about it, by the way.
That's good. But it's interesting about the night sky in the Dakotas is that there's very little light pollution.
It is. Ian, you go anywhere in South Dakota, even in the close proximity of, say, Rapid City, which is a fairly developed city, it appears the stars are just laying upon your backyard. It is the most remarkable thing I've ever seen. From a kid who grew up in the Los Angeles area, it was the most wonderful experience of my life. I'd never seen such beautiful skies. And by the way, if you do see something in the sky, you're not likely to mistake what it is, because no matter how small the moon is, you will see it.
Yeah. I mean, so that's what leads me to feel, you know, particularly anytime something happens, or you really do see a difference in the contrast between what seems like of this earth and somewhere else. Now, as a police officer in Los Angeles, let me spin this a little bit into a slightly different direction here, and then I'll ask Ingrid to give us a little bit more on the suicide story. We were talking about the difference between life and death and what can so often happen when you're out on patrol, and how much you have to depend on your intuition and your gut, something that's a little hard to teach, and that there are times when there feels like these sort of divine intervention moments. Have you ever experienced anything like that on duty as a police officer yourself?
No, I worked an awful lot of night shifts. In fact, the early part of my career, most of my shifts, which Ingrid and just about anybody else can tell you who's been in law enforcement, that's what you're going to work. No, there's an added element, I think, because I've always worked, you know, obviously in heavily populated areas. If there was any kind of UFO encounter I could have experienced, I missed it, busy chasing after car thieves and murderers.
No, and I didn't mean outside of UFO. I just mean on the kind of that sort of moment.
No, I do believe that does happen.
Yeah.
Yes, it does happen.
When you're walking up to a...
You are hesitant.
Yeah, because I thought that was an interesting story that Alan White said, when there are times when you see somebody with a light out, a tail light, and you just think, I'm not pulling that person over. I could, but I'm getting a hinky feeling about this. And I thought, that's so, I wonder how many police officers have that experience on a daily basis.
Needless to say, I've read the entire book, and I enjoy all the stories, especially the forthrightedness of all of my fellow officers. I really have to tell you, honestly, there's times when you wish you didn't get involved in anything.
Yeah.
You know, I got a quick story for you. You know, the police sixth sense is very, very real. And as I said before,
yeah, amen.
You know, if the hair stands up in the back of your neck or you hear a voice that says, turn around and go back, then you comply. And you learn to do that as an officer because of all of the life and death experiences that we have. And a dear friend, you know, acquaintance of mine is Ted Schindel. And he's a retired officer from Fort Lauderdale PD. And he shared an incident in the book that occurred while he was working at a local restaurant bar in Florida. And his department allowed officers to work at other jobs for extra income. So Ted goes into a lot more detail, but when he was closing up the restaurant, he took one last sweep of the parking lot and noticed this empty car parked in the lot. And he explains how he walks about halfway to the car, and then this inner voice says, turn around, march right back into that restaurant, and he complies. He thinks nothing of it. He just does it. And he claims that he always answers these thoughts that come through and that he thinks nothing of it. So he advises the owner and the waitress to be sure and lock up the restaurant as they were working late, and then he went home. And it ends up that there were three gunmen laying down in that parked car with semi-automatic and weapons. Automatic and semi-automatic weapons, and they robbed the business just after Ted left. And the owner and the waitress had not locked the doors as advised, and they were severely beaten.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
And then the gunmen were eventually captured the next day, and during a post-arrest interview, one of the gunmen admitted that if Officer Schindel had gone over to their parked car, their plan was to shoot and kill him.
Not bad.
So, you know, intuition is real.
Thanks for the donut shop.
Yeah, thank you so much to Val Rosales for your contribution to the book. Have a terrific night. Stay safe.
And I hope everybody else enjoys the book. It's a fantastic read. True police stories of the unexplained and inexperienced.
Yeah. Yeah, true police stories of the strange and unexpired.
No, I understand. It's a fantastic book, and I feel honored to be in it.
Thank you so much, and while I have a minute, and thank you before we get to the top of the hour, and then we'll start taking your calls coming up on Coast to Coast for Ingrid P. Dean, Detective Sergeant, the editor, and also the contributor of many of these stories, too. Let me ask you about the story about the police officer, and we only have about 2 minutes, but the police officer that was contemplating suicide, the one that ran across, was it somebody, he was looking at down the barrel of his gun, but he couldn't help but think about somebody that he had run into. Do you remember that story?
I do, and it's really interesting. Police officers have issues just like everybody else. You know, we have family problems and things to deal with, and in police work, we have to try to, you know, distance ourselves from that. And this officer got to a point that he was so depressed that he had a gun to his head and he was ready to shoot himself. But he truly cared about this runaway boy that he needed to get him home, needed to take care of him. And it changed the whole course of his life. He didn't shoot himself because he had this one unresolved issue. And some people call it synchronicity or divine guidance, but because he took the time, you know, to save this child, he stepped back and said, I really don't want to kill myself. I have work to do. You know, I really do want to be of service to people.
If it hadn't been for that kid that he had run into, he might have pulled the trigger.
That's right. And the kid acted as an agent for change, really. Yeah. And I think that we all have those agents of change in our life. It might, you know, just be for
time-wise here. I will refer to everybody to the rest of the book, True Police Stories of the Strange and Unexplained. Your calls coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.